Lemonada.
This episode contains themes of suicide. If you or someone you know is considering suicide, please call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.
My mom and dad separated when I was about a year old. Shortly after that, my mother's father died by suicide. So it was not an easy time for my mother, who was such a new mother. She and I were living in New York, and it was just the two of us. Although I know it was difficult for my mom, and even though I was just a little baby, I think our connection was a bit of a lifesaver for her at this difficult time. And of course, she was my whole world. We were a duo. Sometimes my grandma Didi was a part of the scene. She helped my mother to take care of me. Though, in a way, Didi needed taking care of too, but that's a story for another time. My grandmother, whose real name was Grace, was one of five sisters, including Myrna, Frances, Dorothy, and Little Joe. I know it sounds like I'm confusing my family with Little Women or something, but those are their actual names. The mother of these five girls was my great-grandmother, Bessie. That is a big load of fabulous old-timey lady names, right? Bessie, Dorothy, Myrna, Frances, Grace, and Little Joe. I mean, Jesus, it's fucking Grapes of Wrath over there. And from all accounts, Bessie wasn't the greatest mother. So Myrna, the eldest daughter, kind of took over in that regard. And in my mind, it's always been this kind of village of women scraping it together in the 1920s with Myrna as a surrogate mother. So I've been thinking about the mother-daughter bond in its many, many guises: birth mother, adopted mother, foster mother, surrogate mother, because you have to be, stepmother. I have a stepmother whom I completely adore, by the way. It is a unique and fascinating bond, even when it isn't working particularly well. And it's somehow different from the mother-son bond, the one that I have with my two beautiful sons. It's not better at all, but it is distinctly different. Perhaps because built into the mother-daughter connection is that shared female experience. My mom, somehow, against the odds, by the time she became a mother, already had certain instincts that proved to be correct, nurturing, and, well, just nurturing and correct. And hey, if you've been listening to this podcast thing here, you know my mom a little. She has persevered and overcome a lot to become the person that she is. And I think I've talked about it on this show, but she's a poet. And later in life, she's become like a real poet with books published and everything. And a lot of her poetry springs from her family experience. Everybody's family experience is unique, of course, but my mom's has been filled with all of these women. My mother had three daughters, including me, and all three of us are mothers ourselves now. And my sister Phoebe on my dad's side is a mom as well. So there's just like a shit ton of moms and daughters around here. Anyway, my mom really knows her stuff when it comes to being a mother and when it comes to poetry. And she sent all of us, her daughters, that is, this poem. It's by Maggie Smith, the poet, by the way, not the actress. It's called First Fall. And I think it speaks beautifully to the connection between a mother and a child. It goes like this. First Fall. I'm your guide here. In the evening dark morning streets, I point and name. Look, the sycamores, their mottled paint by number bark. Look, the leaves rusting and crisping at the edges. I walk through Schiller Park with you on my chest. Stars smolder well into daylight. Look, the pond, the ducks, the dogs paddling after their prize sticks. Fall is when the only things you know, because I've named them, begin to end. Soon I'll have another season to offer you. Frost soft on the window and a porthole side there. Ice sleeving the bare gray branches. The first time you see something die, you won't know it might come back. I'm desperate for you to love the world because I brought you here. I get goosebumps from that poem. Isn't that a good poem? I think it's spectacular. To put into words the beginning of the journey of being a parent and the connection between parent and child, Lordy, that is a subject that is just giant to me and just endlessly fascinating. How fabulous, then, that I get to connect today with someone who explores these relationships so profoundly in her own writing. So, yeah, today I'm talking to Amy Tan. Hi, I'm Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and this is Wiser Than Me, a podcast where I get schooled by women who are wiser than me. One of the great discoveries for me doing these podcast conversations with seasoned, fascinating women is that there are patterns, life patterns, life experiences that many, if not all, of these women share. One thing that they share is boundless energy, extraordinary amount of energy. Another thing they share is generosity. They're all out there doing good all over the world, and they've all shown extraordinary personal resilience, overcoming huge obstacles and challenges in their youth. So today, I'm going to be talking to a woman who checks all of these boxes and then some. In addition to being the author of powerful stories depicting identity, family, and the immigrant experience, I mean, she wrote The Joy Luck Club, for Christ's sake. Amy Tan is the founder of the Amy Tan Foundation, which provides resources for literacy and educational programs, environmental, conservation, and social justice initiatives in underserved communities. She is the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Humanities, woohoo, and a winner of the Commonwealth Award. She's done everything from writing screenplays and opera librettos to visual art. You should see the birds that she draws with colored pencils. And her latest adventure will be the much awaited, and I am so awaiting it, 2024 book, The Backyard Bird Chronicles. So, yeah. Everybody knows that Amy Tan is a rock star, but did you know that she is an actual rock star? Yeah, she's the lead singer of a rock band that has performed with Bruce Springsteen and Stephen King and had groupies and this crazy-ass cool tour bus. She's as vibrant and fearless and dedicated to her craft as ever, and she just won't slow down, except maybe to have a chat with us. I'm so happy to welcome a woman who is so much wiser than me, Amy Tan. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Wow. What an introduction.
Yeah, how about it? But it's all true. Okay. First of all, for the people who are listening, I have to explain that Amy and I met in Washington, D.C. because we were both blessed to have received Amy received the National Medal of Humanities, and I received the National Medal of Arts. And these are medals that are given out by the National Endowment for the Arts and President Biden. And we sat together the night before the actual event at the White House. They gave a dinner for the medal recipients, and it was really lovely. And Amy was my seatmate and her wonderful husband, Lou, too. And, you know, I have to be honest with you. It was all so overwhelming. I don't know what your experience was with this. I can't remember any of the details of those, like, 48 hours in D.C., like the dinner that night. I mean, I was so excited to be talking to you. I can barely remember what we talked about, except birds, of course. We talked about birds and your drawing, right?
Yes, right. Yeah. It was the same. I think it was the same. It was just overwhelming trying to process why I was there, for one thing.
Yeah, me
and,
too.
And then who else was there and what good things they did. And maybe I didn't do things that really, were deserving of the medal, you know. But that's the kind of thing that always goes through my head. Do I deserve all these wonderful things that come to me?
Well, I think you do. I think it's long overdue. You should have a number of these medals. And then I looked on your Instagram, Amy, and I saw that there was a picture of you getting the medal from Biden. And you said, I thought I was being so cool and calm. And you're like, your head is back and
my mouth is wide open. My teeth are exposed. I look like I'm either drunk or, you know, having a dance moment. Like
right.
I'm about to dance with him. Yes.
Totally. And I had this, first of all, it's a charming photograph. I love it. But I had the same experience because I have to tell, I when I went up there to get it, I was so overwhelmed and he put the medal around my neck and I thought I would do a joke that the medal was too heavy. And I sort of did this thing like I was collapsing. And of course, all the people took pictures of that moment. So it's so bizarre. I'm making a face, yeah. I'm hamming it up. And I had, and then it happened all so quickly. And then afterwards, I forgot to stand there and take a picture with him because I was so overwhelmed. I was like, I gotta get back to my seat. It was all so crazy, wasn't it?
It was. I was glad I was not wearing high heels. That I think the combination of the excitement and getting up there would have been too much for me to, you know, remember where my feet were, where the heels were going up those steps.
I was wearing high heels and I was very nervous. That was, it was truly an unforgettable experience. And anyway, I was delighted. Hey, listen, are you comfortable if I say your real age?
Oh, absolutely. I've been giving my real age since before I was this real age. I'm actually now 71, uh-huh. But I started saying I was 70 when I was 69.
Just to get used to it?
No, I kind of forgot. It was like, what age am I? 70. And then no, I'm going to be 70 next year. So that's how much it doesn't really bother me what my age is. I like to say what my age is.
Yeah.
You know, what's bad though, if you say your age, and I have these Chinese genes, so, you know, you tend to have fatter cheeks and so you don't show the wrinkles as much. And I'm waiting for the day I say I'm 71 and nobody says, oh, you don't look your age. And then, then how will I feel about that? Or...
Well, you certainly don't look your age. I love that you say fat cheeks. You have this incredible bone structure and gorgeous skin. And I wouldn't say it's fat cheeks. How old do you feel? Like inside, how old do you feel?
You know, I think it really depends on the context. There are times that I feel like I'm 5 still, or maybe I'm 9, or I'm 21, or I'm 24, or it goes back to different periods in my life that I think are significant. But I definitely feel my age in a mental way. Mm-hmm. But emotionally, I think it bounces around in different ways. All good, you know, not terrible ages.
Got it. So, since you wrote The Joy Luck Club, and here you are, you're about to have your, I don't know which number book is coming out in 2024. I honestly cannot wait for this book, and I have to ask you about it. The Backyard Bird Chronicles. This may be an unfair and sort of ridiculous question, but can you talk about how your writing has evolved since those early days?
Yeah. You know, this may sound... ironic, but that the more I write, the more difficult it is.
Really?
In the beginning. And the key difference is that when I started writing The Joy Luck Club, I was unknown, completely unknown. Mm. I'd never been published, not even a short story or anything, or one short story in a very tiny circulation magazine. And after Joy Luck Club, suddenly it just felt like everybody was watching. And there were the reviews, the good and bad reviews, and people saying all the time, I can't wait for the next one. And suddenly it wasn't a private...
undertaking.
Yeah, it was no longer private. And I had all these expectations weighing on me. And it's taken a long time to undo those expectations. And I try to get back into that place where nobody is watching over my shoulder. So that makes it difficult. The other is that, you know, you want to grow just like anybody else. And there's this feeling that maybe I'm not growing as much as I should. And maybe my freshness that I had when I was first writing is no longer there because I have assumptions now. Or I've learned too much and I've used that as a fixed way of seeing things. And so I have to break out of that as well. Because fiction, writing what I do in fiction, requires me to discover things, for me to find out what this is about at the same moment, in essence, that you would reading it later. You're not going to know what's going to happen. I can't know what's going to happen next as I'm writing it, in terms of feelings, in terms of the emotional resonance. So that's not to do with plot. It has more to do with how does this all accumulate into this one big emotional boom at the end?
How have you been able to free yourself from those expectations that you're discussing? And also, how do you free yourself from what you know? How do you do this? I mean, I'm guessing it's quite hard.
Yeah. One is that I stop reading reviews, both good and bad ones.
Oh, that's so smart.
No reviews.
So smart.
Yeah. I don't read interviews. I don't, you know, if there was a televised thing, I don't look at it again. I don't review my life once it's happened. It goes along with this whole thing of don't do reruns of your life and look for all the ways that it was terrible.
It's good you're not an actor. That's all I got to tell you.
Yeah. Yeah. We who do public things, you know, this is something that's out there that we have to think about that can really affect us in how we perform or write or draw or whatever we do, taking us out of that head space or that heart space. So I don't read the reviews. I also tell myself if I do something stupid, and certainly I will have said many things I wish I could take back on this podcast, but I'll say, you know what? Julie is not going to remember tomorrow, and no one's going to remember tomorrow. Or if she does remember, she won't remember it 10 years from now. So it doesn't matter. Or I say, when I die, who's going to greet me at the gates of wherever I go? Is it going to be a bunch of people laughing at me, or is it going to be my mother? So that sets things in perspective as well. I do a number of things to try to get it out. A lot of it is just head in the sand.
When did you start to realize you had to do that in order to move forward creatively? Was that a while ago?
Yes. I stopped reading reviews with my second book. And I found, because every single bad thing ever said about my books stuck in my head in the middle of the night. It was like cat pee on my pillow. You know, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I couldn't get rid of it. So I stopped that completely. And it's been great. I don't miss it at all. Some people think, well, isn't that hard not to know? And I just say, you know, you can just assume somebody has said something negative for their various reasons. And part of it is to realize that nothing they can say has really anything to do that is important about what I was doing, why I was doing it. They can't, you know, if I pay attention to it, that means I have to assess why I was writing something. Was I writing to please somebody? And, you know, should I change my writing now because somebody didn't want to hear about dogs or hear about, you know, they think my story should go back to being a certain way. Should I do that? So there's no helpful advice I can get from reading reviews of something already done. So that hasn't changed.
That hasn't changed since The Kitchen God's Wife, right?
Yeah.
Right. You know, I do make the mistake of reading reviews. I try not to read bad ones, but it is interesting because when I get a bad review, it has a cat pee-like quality in that it's here to stay in my brain. It takes up some space in my brain, and not welcome space, but it's invaded.
Yeah.
And and so therefore the opposite has to be true too. You can't give too much credit to the good reviews, the raves, the whatever.
Exactly.
You have to discard as all of them. Right. And I'm going to guess, you tell me if I'm right, but it seems to me in terms of your trying to constantly sort of free yourself from a way of thinking or as you attack your, because that was the second piece of this, you strike me as somebody who does new things a lot. I mean, Your drawing is extraordinary. You sing with a rock band. You like to, you know, it seems as if, I don't know if you were snorkeling or scuba diving, but with the sharks and the and so on and so forth. So, I mean, is that a part of the process for you? Is trying new things?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's definitely very consciously something that I do. I mean, I don't sit down and say, gee, what are the five things I should do in the next 10 years?
Right.
But I'm very conscious of the fact that I should try something new constantly. And it really has to do with things that I've thought I have would have wanted to do, as well as attempting things that always scared me. Sharks used to really terrify me. And I used to be scared of swimming in the ocean.
With good reason, I might point out. I mean, that is not an irrational fear, Amy Tan.
It actually, there are a lot of sharks that are very harmless, and the number of shark attacks are very exceedingly rare.
Yes.
I wouldn't go out and deliberately swim with great white sharks, covering myself with, you know, steak juice or something.
Right.
But, you know, a whale shark is the most benign creature out there, a curious, benevolent creature who was very aware of me and swam next to me the whole time. When I tired, it would slow down and let me keep up.
Where were you? Where were you when you were doing that? The whale shark. I did it too once.
I was in Isla Mujeres, and the time to go is middle of July, I think. And yeah, it was spectacular. It was life-changing.
Aren't they the most gorgeous animals? Isn't the pattern on the skin the most exquisite? It's like it's designed by a designer. I guess it is designed by a designer.
Definitely.
Right.
But it's bad to touch it, I learned.
Sure.
And they told us, you know, not to touch the whale shark and don't get into its space. But the whale shark was coming really close to me. And it was right against me, and I needed to be at least an arm's length away. So I put my hand, my fist against the side of the shark, just so I would be that distance. And I got out of the boat, and I saw there was blood dripping. And I thought, what's this blood? And it was my knuckles, because the shark skin, remember how they say shark skin is very rough? That's what it is. It's very rough.
Wow.
It didn't feel that way at the time. You know, you're so excited. You're not aware that your skin is being taken off, sandpapered off, you know, but there it was.
Wow. But the adrenaline kept you probably from feeling it. And
oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just so excited. And you know, other sharks, they're white-tipped sharks. They're not that big, so they're definitely not going to try and eat something that's beyond what would normally be on their diet.
I was in the water once. We were in the waters off the coast of the Bahamas, and this is a long time ago. And I don't want to scare you off sharks, but I was in the water. And my husband, Brad, came to the boat, and I was far from the boat. I was just paddling around. We were doing a thing with dolphins, and it was a scientific boat, believe it or not. And I was just paddling around, and he comes to the bow of the boat, and he says, Jules, I don't want you to panic, but you need to come back to the boat. There's a shark in the water. Anyway, I did get back to the boat. I kept my eyes on the ladder. I didn't take my eyes off. And it turned out it was like a 12-foot bull shark that had been in the water. Getting back to the boat was smart, for sure.
Yes.
More with Amy Tan after the break. This episode of Wiser Than Me is brought to you by Maker's Mark. You may not know that Maker's Mark co-founder Margie Samuels was the designer behind the original label. And now, in honor of Women's History Month, Maker's Mark has partnered with the talented artist Gail Kabaker to hand-paint a beautiful label, which you can personalize with the name of a wise woman you know, someone who has made an impact on you or in their community. I'm so happy to be here at Lemonada Media, which is women-founded and women-led, an excellent example of what a community of women can do when we come together. We'd like to salute this whole network of strong women, especially the staff of Wiser Than Me, who are mostly women, by the way. So come join in on the fun. This month, order a free label and let a wise woman in your life know just how special she is to you. Head to makersmark.com/personalize, fill in the details, and then shout out the woman you know who is making a difference. Maker's Mark makes their bourbon carefully, so please enjoy it that way. Maker's Mark Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, 45% alcohol by volume. Copyright 2024 Maker's Mark Distillery, Incorporated, Loretto, Kentucky. If you're anything like me, you're probably planning to travel for a few weeks out of the year. It might be just for a few days, for a long weekend, or perhaps it's a couple of weeks away for a family reunion. Think about those times away and picture listing your space on Airbnb. It could be an opportunity for you to turn those situations into a practical and even profitable one. You might be thinking, my place couldn't be an Airbnb, but that's not true. If you're concerned about the time commitment, you could give it one try and see how it goes. It is a practical way to keep using the space even when you're not there. So if you're curious about hosting on Airbnb, find out how much your space could be worth or visit airbnb.com/host. It could be the start of a whole new chapter for your home. Go to airbnb.com/host. Meal kits can be a big help, but on busy nights, who has time to cook? That's where Factor steps in. They're making it super easy to eat well this season with tasty meals that won't take forever to prepare or make a huge mess in your kitchen. Every one of Factor's fresh, never frozen meals is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. You can pick from 35 different meals every week, like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Looking for something a little more premium? Factor lets you select special ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. With Factor, you don't have to worry about prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Just warm up the nutritious, delicious meal and enjoy. You can also pick how many meals you want each week. And if you need to, you can stop or change when your meals arrive to fit your schedule. Factor is here to give you quick, fancy meals without any cooking. And there's more. You can also find over 60 extra items like breakfast, lunch for when you're out, snacks, and drinks every week to keep you going and feeling great all day. Head to factormeals.com/wiser50 and use code WISER50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code WISER50 at factormeals.com/wiser50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Hey there, Wiser Than Mears. Just a quick note before we get back to the wonderful Amy Tan. I want to tell you real quick about my new movie called You Hurt My Feelings. It's a little comedy about the little white lies we tell to the people we love the most. I play a writer who discovers that her longtime adoring husband, who said he loved her latest book, actually hates her latest book. Can you imagine that mindfuck? It was so superb to work again with Nicole Holofcener, who is the writer and director. The entire cast is truly unbelievable. I'm so proud of the damn thing. You Hurt My Feelings is out this weekend in theaters everywhere. I hope you go check it out. My experience of your writing is that it comes from the most compassionate place. It feels like you get into the skin of your people, your characters, with tremendous empathy.
Yeah, I think most writers do that. You have to be sympathetic to your characters. But I also think that imagination, or fiction especially, is it's good practice for compassion. It's the way we exercise that, because we're putting ourselves into the lives of these imaginary characters, and we take on their circumstances and their history, their personal history. But before you think that I am this great compassionate person who's, you know, got it together, I'm somebody has a problem with forgiveness. So,
oh really?
Oh yeah. You know, when somebody has betrayed me, I have a hard time with that. And I usually, what I do is I just let go of that relationship, and I don't really give it a second chance. It's not the one little thing, you know, it's not that one person said, I really think her book stinks. that would not be enough for me to, you know, give up that relationship. But it would be something a little bit bigger and much more hurtful. And I won't get into those things, but I do sometimes look back and think, well, maybe I've cut off so many relationships because I know so many people. Or maybe it's because people see me as a target, and so they will, more people will do things like that. I think it's a not a huge problem, but I think it's an issue that I have to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about that. Talk about forgiveness and your family. I'm curious if you don't mind, because I'm thinking about how your mother and her behavior towards you, and you've certainly forgiven your mother, it seems.
There's nothing there to forgive. You know, she did things for certain reasons that I understand now, and everything has transformed. All those wounds that mm-hmm. were there are no longer there. My mother actually did a wonderful thing in apologizing for all the things she'd done that hurt me.
And yeah, tell that story when she was ill, right?
Yeah. She had Alzheimer's, and about 2 years into it, she didn't really speak that much. She certainly couldn't call me. She didn't know how to call. And I got this phone call from her, and she was panicked, and she was speaking clearly in English sentences. And she said, I'm scared. I don't know where I am. And I said, you're fine. We often, you know, forget things. No, this is different. She went on. And then finally she said, I just want to tell you that I know I did things to hurt you when you were little. And I said, no, you didn't. And she kept insisting. And then she said, I just hope you can forget just as I've forgotten. And that to me wiped away every single wound that I had had since I was little. And when I was an adult, anything she had said, it just removed it completely. And I was so grateful she had said that. I didn't even have to think about what all the different situations were with the same kind of pain, because she had in that moment come back into this consciousness just to tell me that.
I find that so moving, and that is such a blessing that you had that opportunity with her.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a blessing. In your family, a lot of things were kept secret, not talked openly about, right? And a lot of family secrets are obviously rooted in shame. And I have in my family, you know, there was a lot of actually suicide in my family, and there's a lot of shame connected with it. My grandfather died by suicide, and my grandmother really talked about it like as if he had a heart problem.
Mm.
There was a lot of shame around that. Mm-hmm. How have you broken mm-hmm. that? How have you liberated yourself from that feelings
that
of shame?
Trauma.
Yeah, the trauma.
Well, I think that the real danger of a secret like suicide in the family is that you don't understand why people are spinning out of control in the way that they are, or that this urge could somehow be planted in you without your knowing it because of the way that, you know, people react. My mother's mother killed herself, and my mother saw her do this and was by her side as she was dying for over a couple of days. She overdosed on raw opium, deliberately took raw opium and swallowed it in a New Year's rice cake. The idea was that it'd be sticky and wouldn't be able to be extracted. My mother told me when I was growing up, she died accidentally. Later, she died accidentally eating opium. You know, you'd think that I would question why was she eating opium. Mm-hmm. Later, she said it was she didn't mean to kill herself. She just wanted to scare the guy. Later, it became clear to me by the circumstances and the date she did it and everything that it was deliberate. Mm-hmm. There was, my mother became suicidal. She attempted numerous times, was hospitalized numerous times. I found out my sister, one of my sisters was suicidal and made several attempts. Wow. And I could, you know, I could feel that in me at times this sense that was overwhelming where, I just felt like I needed to escape. I needed to just obliterate everything so I wouldn't have to feel this anymore. And that was earlier in life. And I was lucky to recognize what that was, that the feeling is equivalent to something like, it's like a Charlie horse, or it's like a, you know, these feelings, these bodily sensations you cannot get rid of. They're automatic. And yet I recognize that when I had that, I could sense that. And I know, oh, that's the feeling my mother had. That's, you know, why she had no place else to turn to. Mm-hmm. And I think by being aware of it, that this was a reaction, I could look at it and not let it overcome me, knowing also I had these other ways of dealing with that, like writing. I could write what was bothering me. I could control my future. I could control what I wanted to do. I had choices. They didn't. So I was not faced with the same circumstances. But I think it was good for me to recognize that this impulse was something ingrained in me.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it was modeled for you in addition. I mean,
yes.
It's,
Yeah.
Is that still a struggle for you? Is that something that you still work on?
No. That's not. That was something that was there in my 20s, for example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there was a very pivotal moment experience that happened in my 20s. I was in a doctoral program then, but our roommate and one of our closest friends was murdered. And that murder really changed how I had to look at my life. And I was the one who identified him. And it was a terrible, brutal murder. And had to go through the trial. But I had dreams every night between his murder and the end of the trial, and they just changed me completely. You know, that to unpack basically all these insecurities, all these ways that I dealt with situations in life, depression, all of that. It just unpacked it in these dreams one by one. And, better than paying a psychiatrist.
That was my next question.
$200 an hour, whatever.
just go to bed and have a dream and work it out. But wait a minute, really? So have you been in therapy? Have you ever tried therapy?
I went to therapy once for 4 months because I was working 90 billable hours a week and people kept telling me I had a problem. I had workaholism. And I said, no, I don't, because I don't like what I'm doing. They said, that's why you're a workaholic. You can't stop working even though you don't like what you're doing. So I went to talk to this guy, this Jungian psychiatrist, and he did the best thing for me. He fell asleep 3 times and then I quit. And I decided what I had to do then was not do what I didn't like. I should do what was important to me. And I started writing fiction. So that was great. He offered to help me write fiction. And I thought, really? Are you kidding me? I think you should give me back the money I paid for this.
I think you need your money back.
Yeah.
First of all, I have to tell you, I can't believe you're telling me that because I've been to a couple of therapists in my life. And two of the therapists that I went to both fell asleep during a session. And I remember...
Don't you feel better? Don't you feel better now?
I do. I feel better now that we have this shared, absolutely bizarre experience. I remember in both circumstances being paralyzed. Like, should I just stay quiet so he can continue?
That's what I said. Should I not embarrass him that he fell asleep?
Yeah.
Should I
Meanwhile,
say
I'm mortified, but I don't want to make him feel bad about himself. Isn't it a strange reaction, right?
Well, I also analyzed for him that it happened only when I was happy. When I was crying, when I was really upset, he was there. He was all ears. When I was talking about what a good week I had, that's when he fell asleep. So I thought he's going to reinforce me to be unhappy. And this is very unhealthy. And I told them that, you know, I said, you could really do people a lot of damage because the message there is that I don't count and also that I'm boring, you know, and that if I'm not miserable, I'm not interesting. So this is bad therapy.
And I love your balls in that situation. I do. I really am admiring of that. Did he hear you when you said that?
Well, I wrote it in a letter. Mm. But I did what you did is I went back and I realized, you know, I had not said anything because it was embarrassing. And then I said, no, you have to say something. So I wrote it all in a letter, but he never responded. I asked for my money back too, but he didn't give me the money back either. So this guy died a while back, but I think he's probably heard me repeat the story that I started writing after my psychiatrist fell asleep three times.
Well, I hope his family has the letter because that's a valuable letter to hang on to. Even they should have that framed up in there.
not for his legacy, certainly.
No, but maybe for their family legacy. It's kind of incredible, I think. Just going back to your mom. And maybe this is also an unfair question, but like, what's the most important thing that your mother taught you, do you think, Amy?
Yeah.
When there are a couple of like nuggets, yeah.
Yeah. One that really stands out is that I could not let other people determine for me who I was and how important I was. Mm. And even though she was the one who did the most intrusive manipulation of who I was and what my worth was. She did not want me to go out in the world. And if there was somebody who was condescending, that I would believe what this person had to say. And I could see now that she had a real problem with that. Her own mother killed herself as a result of her station in life as a concubine and being told that basically she was worth nothing. She could not tolerate that idea that her life was determined by somebody else. So my mother would often say this, if somebody was, in front of us and you could see that they were acting in a disingenuous, patronizing way, she would say something. This person don't trust them. They are trying to say this to make themselves feel bigger than you are. And that was a constant message in my life. She also said things like, about whether I wanted to be a mother, because at one time I wasn't sure. And I think most mothers would try to make you feel that maybe this is something you really need to be seriously thinking about, having a baby, how wonderful it is. My mother said, if you want a baby, even if you're poor, you can have a baby. You'll find a way to make this okay. And then she said, but if you don't want a baby, no one, not your husband, not your mother-in-law, not your friends, no one should ever make you feel you have to have a baby. And she said, I know what it's like. I was raped every night. I had three abortions. And so she was saying right there, you make that decision. She was a feminist before.
I was going to say, before there was feminism.
Yeah, exactly. She was so modern in her thinking about this. She thought women were better than men. She said something to me about that. You're not equal to a man. You are better than a man. She said that the reason why I should get a job, a really good job, and study hard so I can get a good job is so I could be independent. And if my husband treated me poorly, I could leave without a second thought about how I would take care of myself. Mm-hmm. She didn't have that choice. And so she was building in my mind the strength that I would need to be independent, to not be afraid. Fortunately, I married a really good guy. And yeah. And I do have a good job. But
yeah, but she empowered you. I mean, she empowered you.
She empowered me. Yeah.
Big time.
Actually, tomorrow is our 53rd first date anniversary. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And how many years have you been married?
49.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I know. I feel so lucky.
That is so lovely. I'm so happy you've had such a healthy, long marriage. That's such another blessing, right? I've been married now 30. Oh Lord, it's gonna be 36. Yeah, so it's almost 36 years. Oh Jesus Christ, that's so crazy. Anyway, and it's amazing to be married to one person for that long. You know, I mean, it's that's a lot of life together, isn't it?
Well, we essentially grew up together. It seems I was 18, he was 19. We joke that the secret to a long marriage is separate bathrooms and separate closets, which can be true if one person is really messy and the other one isn't. And our presence to each other after being together so long and knowing we don't need anything, it's little pledges to do something. Like one pledge for years ago, it started with he would cook me 10 new recipes. You know, and I get to pick the recipes. Or when it turned out I couldn't drive anymore because I have epilepsy, he would take me places without ever complaining.
What did you pledge to him?
I didn't really pledge that much because, you know, I would pledge, you know, we would also pledge things that had to do with certain parts of us personality-wise, like, he knows this in me, that if I get upset about something, I can't let it go and I'll obsess about it. It's not that even that I have to be mad. It's just something that went wrong or, you know, bad service or whatever. And I'll just go on and on and on and on. And he'll say, let it go, Amy, let it go, let it go. And so I do this pledge to just let it go, to just say you're right. I'll just say, you're right. Let it go. Let it go.
So that's the gift. The song
that's
from the Disney cartoon.
You know, because these are things that can irritate your partner, you know, and drive you crazy. So we don't need to give each other actual physical gifts, you know, for every birthday or anniversary or Christmas. We just have this more on a daily basis.
That's nice. Yeah. Although if you've got your 50th anniversary coming up in another year, I think you need a monster pledge and or a good pair of earrings. That's my advice.
I actually put a ban on jewelry about 20 years ago. No more.
My husband wishes I'd put a ban on. He wishes. He's hearing this and he's like, oh my God, I'd kill for a ban on jewelry.
I know. Well, he would go to this one store and he'd come back with jewelry. I said, no more, no more. And it meant a lot, but now what am I going to do?
Yeah, well, I mean, you could wear it and enjoy it, for example. After the break, my conversation with Amy Tan continues. Don't go anywhere.
When planning a trip, the journey there and back is always top of mind. It's so important to feel de-stressed, especially when you're on your way home afterwards and maybe a little tired and homesick. Oftentimes, we think about the destination, but half of the traveling is done when heading back home. And of course, you want to feel as comfortable and settled as possible during the journey, even before you set foot back in your space. That's why we're so thrilled to be talking about Delta Airlines today. For most travelers, it's little touches that actually make them feel at home, and Delta Airlines knows what travelers are looking for. Each Delta Airlines flight is tailored to help you feel at ease. They offer incredible in-flight entertainment, over 1,000 hours of it, so you can sit back, relax, and lose yourself in something you've been meaning to watch anyway. You can also stay connected through fast, free Delta Sync Wi-Fi available for SkyMiles members, which always makes a flight time feel shorter, right? And how about the snack options? First of all, if you're gluten-free, you can rest easy because their snack options have you covered. And their extensive premium beverage options like herbal teas, cold brew, and sparkling wine make the flight all the more enjoyable. Plus, Delta Airlines offers more sustainable alternatives for in-flight dining like plant-based dishes, bamboo cutlery, and organic, nutrient-packed snacks. A good flight means a positive end to any trip, right? Trust Delta to Airlines to make you feel comfortable and taken care of. Delta Airlines believes you should feel at home, even if you're 30,000 feet above it. Learn more at delta.com.
We all need sleep, right? There are very few things we should prioritize more than a good night's rest. But did you know that 35% of adults find themselves struggling with the quality of their sleep? And what you might not know is that something as simple as your bedding can play a pivotal role in transforming your entire sleep experience, elevating it from sleep to true rest. That's where Cozy Earth steps in. Cozy Earth offers bedding products that will transform your sleep. Apart from being the softest sheets you've ever tried, Cozy Earth sheets are also temperature regulating. That's a huge draw for anyone who runs hot or cold when they sleep. That means you won't overheat or shiver while still experiencing the superior softness of the sheets. They choose their fabrics and weaves meticulously. You need to feel it to believe it. Choosing Cozy Earth sheets and pajamas will make going to bed suddenly feel like self-care, letting you experience what unparalleled rest and comfort feels like. Plus, Cozy Earth extends a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty. That's a decade of assured comfort and support. And definitely check out their sheet sets if you're looking for a thoughtful gift that your loved ones will be raving about. Treat yourself to the ultimate in comfort and indulgence with Cozy Earth bedding and sleepwear, and prioritize your self-care and sleep health. Use promo code WISER at checkout for 35% off at CozyEarth.com. After you place your order, be sure to let them know we sent you. Select podcast in the survey and be sure to write in Wiser Than Me. That's CozyEarth.com, promo code WISER. This show is brought to you by Liquid IV. As we head into the spring and summer, much of the time we spend outdoors can get pretty hot. So staying hydrated is really important for me and likely for all of you listeners as well. But did you know that electrolytes are essential when it comes to hydration? Your feelings of fogginess, headaches, or all-round tiredness could be connected to symptoms of dehydration. Electrolytes are like little worker bees that help the water you drink get to where it needs to go in your body. That's where Liquid IV comes in. Liquid IV has 3 times the electrolytes of leading sports drinks, plus 8 vitamins and nutrients. Just 1 stick of Liquid IV in 16 ounces of water hydrates better than water alone, all with no artificial sweeteners and zero sugar. But you'd never know from the taste. Liquid IV offers fun, refreshing flavors like pear, white peach, green grape, and lemon lime. But it's not just about the flavors. It's about how Liquid IV makes you feel energized, refreshed, and ready to take on whatever the day throws at you. When I'm feeling dehydrated, I know I just can't really even think straight. That's why I love electrolytes, because they let the water you drink actually go where it needs to go. However you hydrate, grab your Liquid IV Hydration Multiplier sugar-free in bulk nationwide at Costco, or get 20% off your first order when you go to liquidiv.com and use code WISER at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code WISER at liquidiv.com.
Now, you talked about that you have epilepsy. How is your health? Because I know you had a battle with Lyme disease, right?
I still have Lyme disease. It was caught so late that a lot of things are just there, but it's managed. I manage it really well. So the only thing that I can't do is drive, mm-hmm. and I never liked to drive. So I don't feel any limitations there. Mm-hmm. I have the permanent damage, you know, the epilepsy, the neuropathy. But I also now have this great fascination with the brain. I've always had this fascination, but what I've learned is that when something goes wrong with your brain, that's when you learn what your brain actually does. You know, it's miraculous what the brain can handle, what it can do for you, and how much you can still get out of your brain. Even if you have this problem, you can circumvent this problem and try working it out this way. So whether it's a ride from your husband or, you know, whether you can focus on doing something else that is not as limited.
Did you ever see, that reminds me of that, I think it was even a TED Talk, that doctor who studied, was a...
Oh, yes.
Yes, neurologist. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes. She had a stroke.
She had a stroke, and then she was describing and evaluating her stroke as it was happening.
Yes.
That's an extraordinary piece to watch.
I have had microstrokes, apparently, and I'm aware of when, I've been aware of when that was happening, but also with the seizures. It's the little microstrokes that led me to have permanent damage in my brain that causes the seizures. Your brain, describing what your brain is doing, you know, when it's going off kilter and things are getting brighter, you see colors you've never seen before, you didn't know existed. My vision would become like an eagle's, or certain things with the sensations of being on a, you know, standing still and everybody's on a merry-go-round around me. Very odd things. And, you know, you're just saying, this is what the brain does. It doesn't allow that to happen when it's functioning correctly, but it can do this when it's not. So I have this deep appreciation for everything that the brain does. And it's a miraculous organ in your body that you should be grateful for and protect as much as you can.
But you seem like somebody who's fit. Do you exercise?
I do. I started exercising regularly about 8 years ago, I think. My personal trainer and I were trying to think of how long it had actually been. It came at a time when I decided to stop dyeing my hair black and letting it go white. And then I would dye it colors, different colors, if I wanted to, which I have been doing myself. And I started taking personal training, and I've discovered that I have to pay somebody to make me exercise. And I used to think somebody would have to pay me to exercise, but no, I would have said, okay, I'll forgo the money. I don't need the money. And then not exercise. So paying somebody, I know I have to pay this person three times a week. And I've been doing that for the last 8 years. And the pains I used to have in my knees, in my hip, in my back, my shoulders, I don't have that anymore.
Oh, wow.
And my body is so much better than it was 10 years ago or even 20 years ago.
So you won't be asking your money back from this, from your trainer, like you did your psychiatrist.
No, you know.
This is money well spent.
And he has to listen to me talk too, you know. So it's like the psychiatrist, you know.
Yeah.
He knows more about my life than most people.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. That's incredible. I love it. So let me ask you, is there something you'd go back and tell yourself at the age of 21, if you could?
I'm trying to think at age 21 what I was most concerned about, and that was that I should have a plan for the rest of my life securely in place, and that if I was not getting everything aligned properly, this would be a disaster. And I would want to say that it's not going to happen the way you think at age 21, that all these things that are lined up, they probably will fall away anyway, and it won't matter. And that what you'll end up doing is something that is more meaningful to you once you really learn who you are, because that's what's happened. I started off thinking I'd get a doctorate in linguistics and teach at a university, and I'd have to get this paper published and make this discovery. And then my friend was murdered, and I realized this was a really selfish way to look at my life, and I should do what he was going to do and work with people with disabilities. So I talked my way into a job to do that. And then it went from there. I've had different jobs leading up to my becoming a fiction writer. None of it was planned in a particular way. certainly not the murder of my friend, not the thing that led me to leave that field 5 years later, or it never was planned that I would get published. So many things just came to me, and I would tell myself that there will be things that come to you without your even asking for it consciously, that actually are about what's important to you. They will come up, and that will happen. On the other hand, I wouldn't say it to myself at age 21, because I think it was incredibly good practice to go through all those different stages, because all the, even the bad stuff, even the death of my father and my brother when I was young, or even the things that my mother and I went through, those were all what made me who I am. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that I write about. Where I have to look deep inside of me of, you know, what's the meaning of this? That in this narrative of my life, there's nothing I would take out and say, gosh, if I could have, I would have thrown this away.
Right. It's led to this moment. It's led to
who I am and how I think. But that ultimately also means that I have to love who I am. Mm-hmm. You know, if I didn't like who I am, then I'd say, gosh, if I didn't have this, if this hadn't happened, you know, then I could fix it. And I would be the person I would have wanted to be. Mm-hmm. But I am the person I want to be. So I don't have those feelings of going back and changing them. Because I don't have control over it anyway. You know,
right. And that harkens back to Lou saying, let it go. Let it go.
Yeah.
Let it go.
Exactly. Exactly.
Is there something, although you're not that much older than me, but is there something you would like me to know about aging that I don't know?
What I did very consciously, getting older, knowing that I would get old, is I built a house that is universal design.
What does that mean?
It's designed according to ADA specs. So if I was disabled today, if I couldn't walk, if I was in a wheelchair, if I couldn't use my arms that well, I could do very well in the house that I'm living in, because I have level access into the house. Even though there are three stories, it's kind of a narrow built house. All of the bathrooms have grab bars. What looks like a towel bar is a grab bar. We've had guests staying in a guest studio, and they have pulled the towel bars off or ripped off the toilet paper holder trying to get up from the toilet. This is something that happens to elderly people. They have a hard time getting up. So every single bar in our towel bar is a grab bar, as well as having official grab bars everywhere. But they look nice. They're cedar wood, wooden things that look great. Levers for the water faucets that are, if I couldn't control my hands, it's preset to a temperature. All I have to do is bump it up or bump it down, turn it on, turn it off. So many different things related to that. I mean, the kind of self-cleaning toilet. Mm-hmm. I had to take care of my mother's toileting needs at the end of her life, which I love doing. I love that I could be the mom and diaper the child. But mm-hmm. I thought if I didn't have Alzheimer's, I might not want somebody to do that for me. So I have a bidet toilet.
I'm so admiring of how you've thought all of this through. I think that is, I mean, it's astounding. I've never heard of anybody doing something like the way you have. And I'm in awe. I am in awe.
I've had people say to me, don't be so paranoid. You'll be fine. And I thought, it's not paranoia. It's being realistic. You know, it's hopeful, actually.
Yeah, it's being practical.
It's hopeful that I will live for a very, very long time and will actually find some of this stuff useful. So I think of it in those terms. My mother was also a big worrier. And when I was growing up as a kid, I always had 10 worries on my fingers. You know, I'd count them all. And I didn't want to have to worry. And once I did that, I don't worry. You know, the worst can happen. I think this house would be good for a lot of whatever the worst could be. End of life, I could stay here. Mm-hmm. I even have the bed that goes up and down, that kind of thing, which is very useful now.
Yes, of course. It's good for watching TV or whatever, reading. Well, Amy Tan, I have to say, I love your approach to life. I find it very inspirational. And I can't tell you how grateful I am that you took all this time to talk with me today.
Oh, yeah, it's fun. Really. It's a lot of fun. I'm glad. I'm glad we had a chance to talk. We should talk more.
We should talk more.
I'll tell you the real dirt then.
And I'll tell you the real dirt. I got tons of it.
Yeah. You always need a girlfriend you can tell dirt to.
Yeah, that's the best. Yeah, yeah. Totally. Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I'll let you get on with your day and have a happy date anniversary and give my very best to Lou as well.
I will. I will.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you. Thank you.
Bye.
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 Oh, my God, that woman is impressive. My mother's going to lose her mind when I tell her about this conversation. I got to Zoom her. Hi, Mommy.
Hello. Hi, sweetie.
Mom?
Yes.
I just spoke with Amy Tan for 7.5 hours.
So you were a young person when it started.
Yeah, I was young. And now I'm ancient enough to be a guest on my own program.
So Julia, give me some wisdom. The wisdom of the ages, I want. So
she's been married for 49 years. She's about to go out on her 53rd date anniversary with her husband, Lou. And I thought maybe you could tell the story about meeting my Brad for the first time. Do you remember, Mommy? You came. We were in Chicago, and you came to visit.
Well, you were in a play. Was it Brad's Practical Theater?
Yes.
You all were in that. So I had come to see it, and you had been going out with somebody before,
right?
Ken.
Yes.
Anyway, then here came Brad, which I understood that this was Brad, and this was no longer Ken, and so you. So I came, you all picked me up at the hotel and I came down and you said, oh, Mom, you look so nice. And I said, oh, thanks, honey. You do too. And so does Ken. So
we were off to a great start.
And then we go to a restaurant.
Well, wait a minute. I just want to interject here. I wanted to kill you when you did that. I was like,
well, can you imagine?
No, I cannot. Mom.
I was putting up a firewall. But unbeknownst to myself, I was so pleased, you know, to be there and blah, blah, blah. But then, so we go to this restaurant, this fancy French restaurant downtown that was very few, that was just unbelievable.
Oh, so, the name of it just came to me, Le Paraquet.
Le Paraquet, exactly.
Yes.
And so, yes, we're having everything. Yes, do the souffles and bring all the wine. And the sky's the limit. There's no end to this. And so, and the meal finishes and I pull out my Visa card and they say, well, we don't take Visa. And so I said, well, Brad's father had sent him, because he was starting the Practical Theater, sent him a MasterCard.
No, American Express.
American Express, okay, to be used for emergencies. You know, that you've got a business now, this to be used for emergencies. So you looked at me with this, like, fire in your eyes. It's like, oh, Get out of here. And so, because Brad says, well, here, I'll be happy to pay for this outrageously expensive dinner. I mean, it was outrageous. I never spent more than that for dinner.
Yeah, it was a lot of money.
And then you looked at me and you said, Mom, you write him a check here. You go home so fast. So Brad came through the firewall very well. And he forgave. Well, maybe, I'm not sure. I've never asked him if he ever forgave me. So would you talking to him, would you ask him if he ever forgave me?
I have a feeling he has, Mommy. I have a feeling he has. But that was his introduction to you and our family. It wasn't our first date was actually, we played tennis on our first date.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And that was really fun. And then we went and we got sandwiches, and I remember we were sitting on a curb eating sandwiches or something, and he was talking and talking, and I kept thinking, this guy never stops talking. I don't know if he was nervous or what, but I mean, it was just like, it was a nonstop. Anyway.
That's wonderful. By the way, at the event at the White House, which it was just otherworldly. It was so fantastic. Daddy was sitting down, and he sat down next to a gentleman, and they got to talking. And the gentleman said, "Why are you here?" And so he said that he was your dad and Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And so then the guy nods. And so Dad says, "Well, why are you here?" He says, "Oh, well, I'm Amy Tan's brother."
Oh. So
they had a wonderful conversation, this being the talking about you and Amy.
Oh, wow. How interesting. Wow. Yeah. Look at that full circle. That's so
Isn't
cool.
That something?
Yeah. That's yeah. something else, Mom.
So cool.
Yeah,
exactly.
So cool. Yeah. So, Mommy, thank you so much for making time to talk to me for this ridiculous podcast.
And please apologize to Brad and tell him that I'm bringing a check next time I see him.
No, you get, well, feel free to bring us another check, but you did reimburse. You did.
I
remember. You FedExed it. It came like in a quick hot second.
I think that your whole future depended on that payment.
Yeah, so. It kind of did, to be honest.
Well, think about that. Your mother comes to town and scorches him and calls him the wrong name. And I actually liked him from the time I saw him, when I first saw him. I really, adored him. But, well, I didn't quite adore him, but I liked him very much.
You liked
and then
him.
I came to adore him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Love you, Mommy.
Love you, honey. Now I'm going to show you I can leave the right way. Ha, ha, ha. Now you're.
Ha, 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 ha. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of Wiser Than Me. Henry Hall, who wrote this groovy theme music for the show, has a new song out. It's called Suddenly a Kiss, and people, really, seriously, it's so freaking good. So check out Suddenly a Kiss by Henry Hall on Spotify or wherever you listen to your music. And you can find him at Henry Hall Music on all platforms. There's more Wiser Than Me with Lemonada Premium. Subscribers get exclusive access to bonus content. Subscribe now in Apple Podcasts. Wiser Than Me is a production of Lemonada Media, created and hosted by me, Julia Louis-Dreyfus. The show is produced by Chrissy Pease, Alex McCohen, and Oha Lopez. Brad Hall is a consulting producer. Our senior editor is Tracy Clayton. Rachel Neal is our Senior Director of New Content, and our VP of Weekly Production is Steve Nelson. Executive producers are Stephanie Whittles-Wax, Jessica Cordova-Kramer, Paula Kaplan, and me. The show is mixed by Kat Yore and Johnny Vince Evans, and music by Henry Hall. Special thanks to Charlotte Chrisman Cohen, and of course, my mother, Judith Bowles. Follow Wiser Than Me wherever you get your podcasts. And hey, if there's an old lady in your life, listen up. This episode of Wiser Than Me is brought to you by Maker's Mark. Maker's Mark makes their bourbon carefully, so please enjoy it that way. Maker's Mark Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, 45% alcohol by volume. Copyright 2024 Maker's Mark Distillery, Incorporated, Loretto, Kentucky.
Hey, Wiser Than Me listeners. We want to hear from you. By just answering a few questions on our listener survey, you can share feedback about show content you'd like to see in the future and help us think about what brands would serve you best. And even better, once you've completed the survey, you can enter for a chance to win a $100 Visa gift card. The survey is short and sweet and will help us play ads you don't want to skip and keep bringing you content you love. Just go to lemonadamedia.com/survey. lemonadamedia.com/survey.